This podcast may contain disturbing content for some listeners. It's intended for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
So it is Christmas time, and I don't know.
The plan is.
Well, we have a plan. The plan is that we were going to try and record 12 cases for the Christmas season. I don't know how many episodes that'll be, but the idea would be that it would be
the 12 days of Christmas.
12 days, 12 episodes leading up to Christmas. So we started to like sort of cover some cases that happen this time of year. That some are less popular and like fairly unknown, so they may not be as long a case to record. There's a lot going on right now. Like there is the school shooting right after Thanksgiving up in Oxford Township, Michigan. What's unique about I don't like to say that like, oh, that's a boring school shooting, but the truth is there's like not a lot to the shooting itself. There were 7 people injured, 4 students were killed. The authorities pretty much immediately arrested and charged a 15-year-old boy named Ethan Crumbly as an adult, and they hit him up with 24 crimes, including various counts of murder and terrorism and going armed to the terror of the public. What was interesting about his case is they very quickly released and documented a lot of behavior that really should have been addressed starting at home, but also by the school system. And this is Ethan's behavior, his issues. But what they did that was unique here is they ended up charging Ethan's parents.
Yeah, there's been a little bit in the news about like the novelty of this situation where the parents have been charged. And I don't remember in my recollection, I don't remember other parents being charged in any of the at least infamous shootings. Do you?
I don't. And I sort of briefly Googled to see if I could find other examples of this type of responsibility being levied against parents. And I couldn't find any off the cuff. I found some other things that had gone on where there were instances of parents being charged as accessories after the fact. Most of those end up with like plea bargains or being dismissed. This one, what's interesting is they didn't charge them as accessories after the fact. They just straight up charged them with 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter for their failure to secure the gun that Ethan had used in the shooting. What do you think of that?
I think that the move was 100% correct.
Yeah, this is a hard one for me. That's one of those charges that it seems accurate, kind of on the nose for what happened.
Well, and there's a lot of outcry right now about how you're right. There was behavior, like telltale behavior, leading up to the shooting, and that behavior included him being observed by a teacher. Looking up ammunition on his phone during class, and then like a series of drawings indicating, gun violence and some wording. I think that was a little bit scary as far as I can't make it stop, or
I'm not really. Won't stop. Help me.
He was sent to the principal's office or the counselor's office. I'm not even sure which one. And his parents came to school and he went back to class after this. And there's no way that, any of the school officials could have known that he would have had access to a gun. I personally would assume most kids don't have access to a gun, right? And in large part, that's why a lot of the perceived threats aren't actually threats, is because these kids can't actually get their hands on guns to use, right?
Yeah.
And the parents didn't check his book bag and they didn't bother to mention it to anybody. And it wasn't like this gun was like a gun they'd had for years at home locked away. They had just bought it for the kid the previous Friday. Yeah. So that would have been Black Friday, right?
Yeah.
They bought him a gun. They took him shooting. And he gets called. They get called in because he's basically alluded to the fact that his mind is telling him to go on a shooting rampage. And then they don't even take him home. They leave him at school after this has occurred. This is 100% on the parents. And I will say it loudly. If your child goes on a shooting rampage because you bought them a gun, or you have bought them a gun and they go on a shooting rampage, it is absolutely your fault.
Like I said, it would be very difficult for me to defend the actions in these circumstances. I think we do have to be careful. There's an element of this that they're absolutely 100% at fault of. And then there's other situations that I've read where there's some parents that don't know what's going on. This is not one of those cases from what it looks like.
I'm not saying they even knew that the gun was in his book bag. I'm saying that they should have taken every step that they had to take to know for certain that it wasn't way ahead of time. I don't feel like they should have bought a 15-year-old a handgun. You know, if the dad wanted to have it and he wanted to allow, teach his son how to shoot it and everything, but not give him the impression that it was his gun, that's one thing.
I can't imagine. So just shooting a gun for my kid has been a huge deal. There's not going to be any ownership under the age of 21 that
I'm... Right, and I don't feel like they legally bought it. It was supposed to be the father's gun, but like the kid posted on social media and everything. And, he posted something that ended up being deleted, but it was basically an indirect threat at the school. That's horrifying. They haven't released the video of the actual shooting, but what has been entailed to have happened is he went into the bathroom with his book bag. Then he exited the bathroom without his book bag, and he just began, like, stone-cold killing. It was over within five. Like, he didn't even shoot for 5 minutes. He had already put the gun down and had his hands up. I have a really hard time processing any of that.
Kids with that kind of disconnect from reality with the wrong parents, that's very complicated situation. Responsible gun ownership is a huge deal. It's a huge, 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 huge deal. And when gun ownership is not done responsibly and situations like this occur, I can only imagine it's going to get to be more and more commonplace that there will be charges related to being an accessory, or in this case, into being indirectly responsible, because they didn't hold him responsible for straight up murder. They held him responsible for involuntary manslaughter, which is an interesting choice. One of the weirdest things that came out of this is I noticed that Ethan Crumbly had been appointed a public defender.
Yeah, and his parents hired.
And his parents have hired an attorney, which you asked me about briefly what I thought there. I don't know, but I will say this. I have a feeling this is going to be a pylon case, and I think that the DOJ will get involved. I think the Department of Justice will go after the parents for federal gun charges for transferring the firearm to a minor.
Right. If that applies, I think they should. But I think that this case will actually help stifle. I mean, I'm not saying it's going to completely eliminate them, because who knows, but I do think that it's going to help stifle, something like this happening again. I mean, most parents who own guns, I hope, realize you shouldn't give them to your minor child. They should keep them locked securely where your child can't get to the gun. That's not what happened here. Whatever they did do in terms of making sure he didn't have it with him at school, which is like, I can't even believe I have to say that, right? It seems to me like it wasn't enough, and they should have known it wasn't enough. And now, you know, four kids have died because, I mean, they, at the end of the day, I know a lot of people are saying the school didn't do enough and the school should have done more and everything else, but it is the parents. It's on the parents.
Well, so that happened. And I'm not blowing that off. There's just not a lot I can offer.
Now, I think they'll, so they've been charged with four counts of involuntary manslaughter. And I believe it, it's like 5 to 60 years would be their time for each count.
Yeah.
So they're probably all going to be in prison for a really long time.
Yeah, I get the impression.
You know what's really interesting to me? I'm surprised that one of the parents didn't take the rap.
They couldn't. They had both been so ingratiated in this kid's nonsense that there was no way it could be one of them. They
posted on social media.
Yeah, they both posted on social media. I think the mom, or I don't know if she's mom or stepmom yet. I haven't looked at that really closely.
She's mom.
She even texted and said, you know, don't do it, related to Ethan taking the gun when they realized the gun was gone. So
yeah, he was already in custody at that point. They were way too late.
Yeah, they missed the boat on that. And unfortunately, there was nothing they could do. They were already deep in that one. What they could have done would have been ahead of time, and they decided that that was not the case. But that's not the case we're covering today. All right, the case we're covering today is even weirder. This is a pretty old case. It is a Christmas case. So that, you know, ultimately we're trying to cover the cases that we're trying to cover right now are from this time of the year. And some other people have covered this. You ended up sending me a whole book on this. And I'm not convinced that this would not make a terrific Netflix series, like a horror series.
Right. Or at least like movie.
I'm not sure which one it would make, but yeah, one or the other, because I even came up with a title I'm sort of joking around with. The book that you sent me is called Zero to the Bone. It's if you want to read this book, you can actually go just to archive.org or the Wayback Machine and go to the book section, and you can find Zero to the Bone in there. It's free. If you can do a free account and you can borrow it like a library book and you can read it right on your phone or tablet or your desktop. I ended up having to read this on an iPad because it didn't, it was not easy to read this one on the phone. It's, this is a story. This is not a serial killer. And, Bryce Marshall is the author of the book. You're asking me, like, where do I think he got the information from? He pretty specifically outlines in the beginning that he did a lot of research with the local police and the lawyers involved, and he took a lot of the statements and interviews and trial recantations here. But this is a story of a guy named Ronald Gene Simmons Sr., who was an American spree killer. And the week of Christmas in 1987, he killed 16 people in Arkansas. 14 of them were members of his own family. One was a former coworker, and one was a complete stranger. He was actually trying to kill someone else, and he wounded 4 people. And the way that he did this, his weapons were hammer, a crowbar, a rope, an H&R model 9.29 22 caliber revolver, a Ruger single 6 22 caliber revolver, and water. Weirdly enough, he used water to kind of verify that these kids were dead. What did you think of this guy's story? Just like, not that part, but like the rest of his life, since this book goes into pretty big detail here.
He's what I consider to be like an ultimate loser.
I get really confused by these types of family annihilators. And, you know, he's not the only one we've seen like this. If you go back 58 years earlier, is the Lawson family murders. Have you read up on that one at all?
Yes.
It's very similar situation in that, I think with Gene Simmons, he goes by Gene, by the way, that's what everyone called him in his life. So in the book, he's addressed as Gene Simmons. I think he and Charlie Lawson have quite a bit in common, in terms of how their stories went down. But I think we know more about Gene Simmons because, you know, it happened 60 years later and a lot of people talked to him and he seemed really willing to talk.
So a lot of the story unfolds about basically he was in service and about how he, you know, sort of moved around in service and he was misogynistic and chauvinistic towards his wife. He wanted her like at home with the kids while he went to work and he provided very basics for her. And when he was gone for extended periods, being on assignment, you know, being in the service, like he would do things like take the wheels off the vehicle so she couldn't drive it. And he put her in like really embarrassing situations where she would have to like either go without or get help from like her family that she was sort of estranged from thanks to him. But he was just like, and it went into pretty, and I assumed, I was asking you if you had any idea, I assume, you know, service records are some of like the most well-kept records in like the National Archives, right? I mean, you can find all kinds of things about discharges and him being put, you know, located, relocated and all this stuff. And I assumed that a lot of that information came from records, right?
Yeah, a lot of this was. So the way his service broke down, just briefly for people who haven't read all this, he was in the Navy from 1957 to 1963, and then he got out, and he thought he would use the skills that he had learned in the Navy. Mostly what he did was sort of yeoman's work. Like, it's record-keeping and office work is largely what he did. Pretty deep in the details of where he was and when he was where. So I assume that's based on the service records. But he doesn't do well in the civilian world when he gets out of the Navy. So in 1965, he re-ups and goes back, but into the Air Force. And he's in the Air Force until 1979. And at that point, he leaves out of the Air Force as an E-7 or a master sergeant, which is not terrible for an enlisted man, but essentially, between those two tours, he's got a full 20 in, and he doesn't rise past E7. He doesn't become an officer. He does have some interesting medals on his chest, including the Bronze Star. And somehow he got the Republic of Vietnam Gallantry Cross, but that appears to be when Saigon was falling. They sort of handed it out to everybody who was in OSI, which was the most interesting part for me, is that he had apparently significant experience with the OSI. Are you familiar with that before this case?
No, I actually don't. I'm not even familiar with it after.
Okay, so the Air Force Office of Special Investigations is like their, in the Navy, people talk about like NCIS,
right.
The Naval Criminal Investigative Services. That's like their special detachment. With the Air Force, it's the Office of Special Investigations. To get in there back then, you had to be held in pretty high regard. A lot of what they end up doing in the Office of Special Investigations for the Air Force at that time would have been related to crimes related to national security within the Air Force and drug investigations. But it's a very small, unique operating agency within the Air Force. And this guy was in Saigon, attached as basically an analyst, not so much an investigator, but as an analyst for the Air Force's Office of Special Investigations. He ends up coming back to the U.S. After Vietnam. He's sort of becomes a master at running a scam. He doesn't even realize he's running a scam. He's really just trying to get as much out of his military service and military experience as he can. And there are multiple instances where he has described basically being a thief and stealing from the PX in a way that like it won't be noticed. At one point, he's assigned to like officers' quarters to make things really nice for visiting officers, specifically generals, come in and go from the the area that he's assigned to record keep, and he like takes the nice soaps and the nice towels and the nice robes on his way out of the Air Force. He spends a lot of time dreaming, from what the book tells us, about having his own little world, like having like a, I don't know what you would describe it as, but it's almost like he's like a hermit who has a compound sort of that he's built on his own out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, he's the king of his little pretend world there.
Yeah, it is a pretend world, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he doesn't do well in the civilian world.
I agree. He didn't do well. I feel like he had his issues even in the service, but yeah, in the civilian world, he just wanted like utter and complete control.
With his situation, somehow he ends up married to a woman. She goes by Becky, but a woman named Rebecca, and they're married for a really long time. And this book goes into excruciating detail. This book actually covers, it's about 30 years that it covers in depth. It's kind of hard to read overall. It's very dense, but you were right. You said, I think you texted me like, you will like it when you get to the end and they start wrapping stuff up. And it really does.
It gets better.
It is mind-boggling how it wraps up. Gene ends up in 1981 in New Mexico. And at that point in time, how many kids did he have? They had five, I think, or six?
That's a loaded question. Hold on.
I know he ends up with a total of seven kids, but like in 1981.
All but the youngest, I believe, would have been, so six. He would have had six, I think.
Yeah, so the very youngest causes a problem for Gene in April of 1981. I believe that's technically the seventh child. Is that right?
Little Becky is his daughter with his wife, and Sylvia is the daughter that his oldest daughter bore by him.
So that's what I'm getting to. And this is the thing that, like, you know, this was one of the suspicions with the Lawson family murders, was that the oldest daughter in that case was potentially pregnant by the father, her father.
Right. And so we don't know about that. But what we do know is that Gene Simmons' oldest daughter, Sheila Marie, had a daughter by him named Sylvia. And it basically explains in the book that the reason that happened was because his wife had decided after, I believe, little Becky was born, that she didn't want to have any more kids. And so he was basically grooming his oldest daughter to like become his new wife. It was crazy.
It is bizarre. And the idea is that the doctor tells Rebecca, his wife, I'm just saying, like, he calls her Becky, and throughout the book they call her Becky. I'm just calling her Rebecca here, because there's another character, Becky, who is the last kid they have, little Becky. Once that child is born, the doctor basically says, look, you've had so many kids, you really need to get your tubes tied, because you don't need to have any more children. And he scares her, the doctor scares her by basically saying, if you have another kid, you can die. We don't see a lot of backup for this information. It's told from largely the perspective of the leftovers. Because by the time these people are writing this book, Gene Simmons is already been convicted. And at this point in time, he's dead. So I guess we should get into why that happened, because it's pretty nuts. They had been living this isolated life in New Mexico. And Gene's a pretty paranoid dude. So once he gets his oldest daughter, Sheila, pregnant, and she has a kid, because of the way he acts and because of like how terrible all of this behavior is, and as you expressed previously, he is misogynistic, he is chauvinistic, he's controlling, he's manipulative, and not even in like a smart way. It's not like he's like some genius. He's actually like doing some stuff that's pretty stupid. He gets super paranoid that Cloudcroft, which is where they live in New Mexico, the authorities there are basically collaborating with the Department of Human Services in New Mexico to put him in prison. So he flees, and he flees to Arkansas, and they spend several years in Ward, Arkansas, and then they move over to Dover, Arkansas. In the summer of 1983, he starts moving them to Dover. He basically has a 13-acre tract there, which is just north of Dover, but they call it Mockingbird Hill. And this residence is constructed of two older mobile homes that have been put together to form one large home. Neither one of them have indoor plumbing or telephone. And I want to say he made the kids build the pit latrines that they use, right?
He made the kids do all the manual labor.
Right. That's where we're...
The answer is yes. It seemed like that's pretty much all they were good for to him.
It's disturbing, like the level of stuff he tried to do. And I'm talking about, this guy does not have construction skills, not really. So he buys these trailers or mobile homes. And one, that's how he keeps his family isolated. By having these trailers or mobile homes, he can control like where they can go. He limits the vehicles. Like you said, at one point, he even puts one of the trailers up on blocks. And the van that was with it is up on blocks at the home of his in-laws, basically. In reading this book, what happens that is, I would call the catalyst event, I don't know if you agree with that or not, is the 17-year-old daughter that he gets pregnant and has a child with, they take that granddaughter and make her a member of the family. His daughter falls in love with someone at a nearby school. His name is Dennis McNulty. When she falls in love with him, they move out. And over from the time that they move into Arkansas, and then his kids start pulling away from him, and she's not the first one to pull away. There's little Gene, who is Ronald Gene Simmons Jr. For purposes of the story, Gene Simmons and his wife in 1986 are in their mid to late 40s. They're both 46 and 47 years old, I believe. They have Gene Jr. or Little Gene. And at the time, he was 28 years old. He would be 29 when he dies the following year. And then they have Billy Simmons, who is somehow Billy Simmons II. I didn't totally understand that one. He's 22. Renata Simmons is his wife. And then there, Sheila Simmons was 24. So she's between Ronald and Billy. And her husband, Dennis McNulty, he's about 8 years older than her. Then they have Loretta Simmons is 17. Eddie Simmons is 14, Marion Simmons is 11, and then little Becky Simmons is 8 when all this is going down. So Sylvia, the youngest, is actually his daughter with his daughter, and she would have been, she would have just turned 6 years old in 1987 when the murders occur. I know that sounds complicated. It's a lot of characters, but these are all the victims of Ronald Gene Simmons.
Right. Plus, he also had Trey Simmons, who was his grandson.
Right.
And Dennis and Sheila's son, Michael. And then, so Michael and Trey, and then Sylvia. And at that point in time, so basically what ended up happening when Sheila decided she was going to marry Dennis, Dennis was aware of like the terrible stuff that had happened, and he adopted her Sylvia, you know, sister daughter. That's such a weird situation.
Poor kid.
He was her father at this point. It was really terrible because Gene Simmons actually sort of made a point to say, he made it seem like, for one thing, she was a kid when all this happened, Sheila was. And he actually implied that nobody would ever want her because she had a child by her father. And so basically she was like damaged goods. And I felt like that was just like so, it was so terrible because what he had done to begin with. And, you know, I get that the mom was afraid of him, but like she knew what was going on. It was so messed up. At the time Sheila got married, and of course her husband is standing up to her father, his father-in-law, and he doesn't like that. And he has basically stolen Sylvia away from him because he's adopting her and he's trying to straighten things out. And so it really was like the best sort of result considering everything Sheila had been through, right? She had found an actual guy who, you know, he seemed like a stand-up type of guy. And I believe that you had sent me something that indicated that that was probably the turning point.
Yeah, so the name of the book was Zero to the Bone. And the thing that seems to make him so as domineering as he is, Gene Simmons has his shit together to a certain point.
He has very strange components together and then very strange components that aren't together.
He's able to keep the family together. They keep these secrets. He's able to buy land. He runs some financial scams you would not believe. He is constantly like stealing money from himself through his own equity, having to take out a new loan that makes no sense to keep this family afloat while Becky watches all these children. And these kids are beautiful. If you see the pictures of them, these kids really are.
They are, like, but they lived in squalor. And the fact that he was so in debt, what was he spending money on? Because it wasn't on their lifestyle, that's for certain.
Yeah, it is ridiculous how little he spends on them for them to be having this terrible a life.
Right. It was really bad. And so I know that it said that that was the turning point, but Becky, his wife, Rebecca, they called her Becky, but we'll call her Rebecca to not confuse her with the daughter, Becky. She had been, at some point, she realized that his relationship with her daughter that resulted in Sylvia being born was leverage.
Yeah.
And so she started sort of fighting back. And so her sons, little Gene and Billy, they had basically convinced her. The plan was over this Christmas holiday, she was going to tell her husband while her boys were there and while the family was there, basically that, you know, their marriage was over. And I wondered, like, how that played into it, because he thought that he was going to, like, reinvent his life by basically having a younger version of Rebecca, his wife, and that younger version being Sheila. He thought that, like, he could just do things all over again. It was really strange. I have a feeling he was probably going to kill Rebecca. I'm actually a little bit surprised he didn't kill her.
He did kill her.
I mean, already.
The authors, okay, and if you pick up this book, you should read it if you're interested in the story, because it is a fascinating look at something. I would think that it's serious mental illness.
Right.
Do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. There's no question that it went beyond just being like a stickler for, you know, because people, as they get older, they get set in their ways, which he certainly was set in his ways, but he had absolutely no consideration for anybody else. And that's crazy considering how big his family was.
Yeah. The level of narcissism that he felt like that, it's extreme. It seems to be backed up by interviews with him and the few people that survived that knew him. The reference in the title of the book was interesting to me. Zero to the Bone was the name of the book. And this is what I wanted to point out to you. There's a Emily Dickinson poem about a snake that ends with N0 at the bone, talking about being cold-blooded. But also, it references moments when fear pierces the human facade, if you will, and how we feel cold. It's a deeply intense feeling of fear. And what I think happened was when he realized all of these things that you just described weren't going to happen, when he realized he couldn't get away with killing his wife, he couldn't get away with marrying his daughter, these people were not in his control anymore. I think he snapped, and he does it as the kids start to leave. He goes, weird to say this, but he goes downhill. He starts gaining weight. He starts trying to control, but he's really just being an alcoholic. And the remnants he is left of fear on the family start to erode. And some of Rebecca's siblings, meaning Jean's wife, Rebecca, her siblings, her sister, starts to notice what's going on. She's actually been sort of against Jean for quite some time. And while this is all happening and he's lost control of his finances, he's not really working. The jobs that he does have, I don't want to say they were made for women, but the impression that you get from the author is that at the time, those jobs were largely considered to be jobs for women. They're like secretarial and office jobs. He doesn't do well at those. He doesn't do well with his coworkers. And he gets himself into this position where he's like a recluse in his own home. He's like sitting in the back of the house. His wife starts to figure out how to communicate with her sister, even though he's controlling the mail and controlling what, he counts the number of stamps they have in the house, so she can't send out a letter. I don't believe they have a phone at the time. They get one at one point, but he's also controlling that. His wife's sister sets up this way for them to communicate, where she starts to acknowledge how bad it is. She finally tells them the whole story, because no one knew about the incest and who Sylvia was. And at this point in time, Sylvia's 5 years old, turning six.
We find out that there were suspicions.
Right. Yeah, we find out that her family and other people, including, you know, some random strangers get in on the mix. They are suspicious that something, not just of the abuse, but also as specifically as, you know, Sylvia being Jean's child. And they start to communicate with her, and they sort of, I would say, bolster her a little bit, because she starts to think, okay, if I get it together, or the way it's presented to us is through her letters. It appears to be through the letters that were used at court. And those letters appear to be her saying, you know, fat Jean down here is not doing anything for me anymore. I may be able to get away from him. And as you said, her two oldest sons, they start to encourage her to get the hell away from this man. They realize that something's seriously wrong with him, father or not.
Right.
When he realizes this, and it takes him a while, he starts planning one last family get together. That's the only way I can think of to describe it. Can you think of a different way to describe it?
No, I think that you're right. So at that point in time, I believe little Jean had, he was separated from his wife, but they were going to try and reconcile, I believe. But in the meantime, he was staying with his parents along with his daughter.
Right.
And, but Sheila was married to Dennis, and they lived on their own somewhere else.
With their two kids.
With their two kids. And Billy and his wife, Renata, they lived with their son, Trey, elsewhere. And so coming up on the Christmas holiday of 1987, so the father of Jean, he calls up his employer and just quits his job.
Yeah, he has been working at the Sinclair Mini Mart for approximately a year and a half. And on December 18th, 1987, he collects his last paycheck and says, I quit.
Right. And it's kind of weird.
Yeah. It's kicking off a series of events that he's really not going to be able to take back.
That is for certain.
So on the morning of December 22nd, he puts in place a plan that is going to ensure that he is together with Sheila, his daughter that he says is his one true love. And here's how it goes. On December 22nd, first he kills his wife, Rebecca, and then he kills his oldest son, little Jean, by shooting them with a .22 caliber pistol in the main part of his trailer. This is two trailers that are together. Then he kills his 3-year-old granddaughter, Barbara, by strangling her to death. He takes those three bodies and he puts them in a pit latrine. The pit latrine was actually dug by his children. All the manual labor that's been done on the four properties they've lived on, three or four properties they've lived on, has been done by his children and him. He then starts drinking and keeping watch of these bodies. He's put these bodies, covered them over with tin sheeting. So he waits for the other children to return to the house. And when the kids get there, this is all on December 22nd, he tells them that he's got presents for them, but he wants to give them to him one at a time. And he starts with Loretta. And Loretta was sort of, in the story, Loretta's the one that might, in a different version of this that was more fictional, she might be the final girl. She's sort of headstrong. She knows there's something wrong with her family. As the story moves along, she's, you know, sharing notes with her other siblings and with her mom, where she's making it clear that she understands that something is wrong with Jean. And she is the only one of the story, in all honesty, that she doesn't take any of his bullshit.
Right. And she's 17. And
17 years old.
She's substantially older than the other little kids that are there. And if she had known what was happening, she would have done everything she could to take him out.
Yeah, she would have been the one that potentially could have taken him
out. Unfortunately, he prefaced the situation with that he had a very special gift for each one of them, that he was going to give it to them each separately, and he wanted her to have her gift first. So she was completely blindsided.
Yeah, so he ends up, he strangles his 17-year-old daughter, and then in the kitchen area of the main mobile home, he has a rain barrel full of water, and he, while he, to make sure she's truly strangled and dead, he dumps her head under the water in this rain barrel. And then he kills Eddie, Marianne, and Becky the same way. And respectfully, Eddie was 14, Marianne was 11, and Becky was 8. So he kills his 4 children that day. What's been in the works is the rest of the family is coming to see him. And they are coming to see him in a way that they won't necessarily be running into any of the other family members before they arrive the day after Christmas. And around midday on December 26th, the remaining members of the family begin to arrive for this Christmas visit where they think everyone is going to be together. The first who arrive are Billy and Renata. Billy comes into the house, and at this point in time, Gene's pretty nervous. He's been drinking and checking on these other bodies and basically absolutely paranoid for almost 4 days that he was going to be caught.
And then he wouldn't be able to finish.
He wouldn't be able to finish the job. So Billy comes into the home, followed by his wife, Renata, and she is carrying their 20-month-old grandson, Trey. So when they get into the mobile home, he baits Billy the same way he baited Loretta, because Billy's older, he's 22 at the time, into coming back for a gift that he is wrapping supposedly for Rebecca, his wife and Billy's mom. And he shoots him. And then he shoots Renata when she comes to check on Billy and Jean. Then he strangles and drowns Trey, the 20-month-old grandson. A little while later, Sheila and Dennis with Sylvia and Michael arrive. Sheila is the daughter that he had sexually abused and was supposedly in love with. Her husband is Dennis. When she comes into the house, Simmons shoots and kills her. And Dennis is outside at the car, and he runs to the house to try and save his wife. And then he is killed. Simmons even recounts in an interview that he felt like he was killed far too soon because he wanted to torture Dennis for stealing the love of his life. And then he strangles and holds underwater 7-year-old Sylvia, and finally his other very young grandson, 21-month-old Michael. So then he laid the bodies of these guys that had been killed on the 26th. He lays them in the front of the mobile home in neat rows, and he covers them all with coats except for Sheila. And he covers Sheila. He wraps her and covers her in his wife's best tablecloth. And the two smaller grandsons, he wraps them in plastic sheeting. And for some reason, he puts them in abandoned cars that are at the end of the driveway. After he accomplishes this part of the murders, this is not everything that's in his plan. He returns to his house and he spends the day watching TV and drinking beer. On the morning of December the 28th, even though he's been frantically drinking and checking on the bodies, and like he's pretty much driven himself almost insane with the paranoia of being caught, but he drove into Russellville, Arkansas, and he walked into a law office and killed the receptionist, a young woman named Kathy Kendrick. There's a really interesting part of the story. Anything stand out to you about that? About Kathy, like the earlier part of Kathy's story?
That she had not been interested in him.
Yeah, she doesn't do anything to him, but he ends up killing her.
Fixated on her, but like he was like a fly on the wall as far as she was concerned. I mean, it was just
she thought he just works here. Yeah, she didn't think anything of him,
and that's really sad.
Yeah, it's sad that I think he pictured if I have to kill Rebecca, my wife, and I can't get Sheila, then maybe I could get Kathy. And like they weren't even in the same league.
She was 24 years old.
Yeah,
like, I mean, she wouldn't have been interested in him ever. And she she never knew what hit her, I imagine. And you know, there were other people in that office that he basically ignored. He just went straight in and killed her and left the rest of them there.
She is aware of his feelings for her, but she doesn't reciprocate. She also doesn't really make a fuss out of it. She just ignores him.
Right. And so if you, let's just take a second here, because we're talking about a middle-aged man who has a wife and a lot of children, and he has a granddaughter with his oldest daughter, and yet that's still not enough for him. He feels like a 24-year-old that he has worked with denying him her affection warrants him killing her.
Yeah.
let that process for a second.
Yeah, it's terrible. I mean, he, for some reason, he is so angry at people in his life here that when he snaps, he has really, really snapped. He next goes to another office nearby. It's the oil company's office. And he goes in because he wants to kill Rusty Taylor. He ends up wounding Rusty, but he's interrupted by a guy named J.D. Chafin. And this is the part where his story really gets sort of escalated to the final phases, because there's a witness, a young woman named Julie, who had just started working at the oil company, saw everything he did and didn't know who he was, but was able to describe him for the police. And so the police have started to get phone calls. They've got a phone call from the law office. It's actually a judge's office where Kathy Kendrick worked. A young lady in that office had dialed into the police and reported a shooting. And then he goes to the oil office and he shoots and wounds Rusty Taylor, and he kills J.D. Chafin. And he's witnessed by a young woman named Julie. So then he has to press on, and he drives to the mini mart that he had worked at, and he shoots and wounds two people there, attempting to basically kill his old boss that he had quit his job with 10 days earlier. Afterwards, he goes to the office of the Woodline Motor Freight Company. There's one more person that he shoots and wounds, but he doesn't kill her. And then he sits in the office chatting with one of the secretaries, asking her to turn him into the police. When they arrived, one of his guns was on her desk. He gives up the other one and he turns himself in. And he basically, the way they describe it in the book is he crashes. He doesn't talk to anybody for several days because of the adrenaline rush and the psychosis he was experiencing. That's a lot, though. That's a lot of murder.
He literally didn't have to commit.
No!
His predicament, even with the psychosis and just all the mental problems he was facing, the solution to that was suicide. And his narcissism is exactly why he didn't commit suicide.
So you think there's no treatment for people like this?
Well, I mean, I think that they could be helped if, like, somebody had managed to get complete control over them and was able to subdue them into, like, submitting to the treatment. Yes, but this kind of person, without that, you know, guardianship over them, they're never going to know they need help, right? Yeah. Everybody yeah. else is the problem. And, you know, he made that really clear. But in this particular situation, sometimes in life, you run into an asshole or two, right? But when all you're running into is assholes, you really have to wonder if it's not you that's the asshole. Right? I mean, and so in this situation, he told Vicky, the lady that was the one he said call the police, he told her that he wasn't going to hurt her because he had taken care of everybody that he needed to take care of.
He was done.
Okay. And he was just like a passing thought to not to his family, but to these other people that he went out and sought out to kill. But they had occupied his brain to the point where he sought them out to kill them. A non-narcissistic person who didn't need to have control over everything, they would have just committed suicide. Because, I mean, they were just at the end of their rope. And so I do believe there's help for people if you can. And I'm sure that psychiatrists have, ways of, you know, doing it. But the very first thing that would need to happen is he would have to realize that he needed help and that it wasn't all of these other people that were the problem.
We're not advocating suicide here. We're just advocating avoidance of the 16 murder counts and the 4 woundings.
Well, and, you know, his plan was to commit suicide. But after one of the victims that he shot initially, I believe it was his son, little Gene, after he was shot, he had a growing concern about turning himself into a vegetable.
Right. He didn't think he would necessarily...
Because he just had 22 bullets.
Yeah, and they were hollow point 22s.
Based on that, he didn't even attempt. He said that he sort of made a split decision that he would just, you know, be taken into custody and he would confess. And he never denied any of it. I mean, he was straightforward and he actually was mad because there were certain, I think, third party groups that, you know, intervened on his behalf as far as appealing the death penalty that he'd been sentenced to, and he was getting more and more aggravated about that because he didn't want anybody intervening. He wanted to be put to death.
Yeah, he pretty much refused to participate in his own defense. At the time, Arkansas did not require an automatic appeal of the death penalty, just a review. And basically, he said to those who opposed the death penalty, in my particular case, anything short of death would be cruel and unusual punishment. He actually got on the stand and made the statement that I, Ronald Gene Simmons Sr., wanted to be known as my wish, my desire, that absolutely no action by anybody be taken to appeal or in any way change the sentence of death. It is further respectfully requested that the sentence be carried out expeditiously. It's interesting how people get to that position and suddenly they want someone else to do it for them.
It also goes to show me, at least, what kind of person, you know, was doing all these terrible things to begin with, right? Because he causes all these problems and then, you know, he wants the state to kill him.
It's so typical, though. Like, he's made this mess and he can't even clean it up.
And, you know, the children he killed, and, you know, I'm sure that there was no justification for it. But to him, he was, like, saving his family, I guess. I don't really understand it. So I don't know if he knew at Christmas that his wife was going to leave him. And I don't know if that was sort of a cat. I thought it was really interesting that they had this plan, that the older children had a plan that basically, you know,
to get her out of there.
She was going to get out of there and take the younger kids with her. And, like, basically the adult children were going to be there if it was necessary, like, as far as their father getting violent, right?
Right.
So I don't know. Like, it's crazy to me. He must have sensed something, at least, right? Because in all the years that they were married, I mean, he picked the exact time she was about to leave to kill them all.
Yeah, I almost wondered if it was creative license that in the books and stories I was reading.
How anybody would know any of that stuff. But my assumption was that he told them.
He told them, and letters were introduced because the sister that was in on the plan had all of the letters where
they'd written back and forth, where
Rebecca was describing what he was doing.
Right. Well, and so it was just crazy that it all came to a head like that. And unfortunate, you know, he had expressed a desire to die. I have a feeling that one of his older sons or perhaps his son-in-law would have been more than happy to accomplish that for him, as opposed to him killing all of these people. He was just stark raving mad.
And he wasn't stark raving mad like he snapped. He was just a lunatic for a really long time.
You know what the most interesting thing to me is, though? He never would have been happy with Sheila. Like, let's say that his morbid, disgusting fantasy came true, and, you know, she did take her mom's place as his wife and, you know, all that stuff. He would have, like, moved on to someone else, and it would have just all started over again.
Yep.
Because he never would have been satisfied. And then for him to, like, have so many opinions when, you know, he wasn't anything really to get real excited about. You know, he wasn't successful. He had no money. He had lots of children and it didn't seem like any of them had an awful lot of respect for him. Not that he had earned it. And, you know, he was basically just a pain. That's what it seemed like to me. I can only imagine having to be around somebody like that and how they would suck your energy right out, you know?
I couldn't do it. I couldn't be that way to anybody. And I also couldn't deal with them.
I have a really hard time bridging a gap on how one gets there. Because I can't imagine, you know, by the time you get to that point, why you haven't taken steps before it gets that bad to, you know, not get that way. If you want to be miserable and you want to torture yourself, that's one thing, but you should let your family go and, you know, not be miserable. And he just couldn't do that.
Thank you for joining us. We are sponsored by LabrotiCreations.com. You can check them out at LabrotiCreations.com, and you can still use the code CRIMEXS for a fun pop pet portrait of your own pet. You can also reach us on Twitter, Instagram at TrueCrimeXS, or you can give us a call if you know anything about any of the cases that we're talking about at 252-365-5593. You can also reach us at Gmail at truecrimexs@gmail.com, and you can check out our website at www.truecrimexs.com. We'll see you next time.
God rest ye merry gentlemen, let nothing you dismay. Remember Christ our Savior was born on Christmas Day to save us all from Satan's power when we were gone astray. Oh,